For a lot of Americans, credit card debt feels like a fact of life.
I think it's just important for people to understand how credit can work for you or against you.
Why that little piece of plastic has so much power. That's this week on Explain It To Me. Find new episodes Sundays wherever you get your podcasts.
Picture this. It's Northern England, early 1800s. The fog is blowing over the moors. The wind howls. The rain beats your brow, further obscuring the view ahead, where through a rock outcropping in the distance is a shrouded figure. He moves closer to you. He's rough-hewn, but surprisingly handsome. He's wearing wool, a fine blazer with elbow patches and dark-rimmed glasses.
Wait a minute.
It's a musicologist who has found great wealth. Heathcliff. I'm sorry. And he's the object of your affection. Nothing can separate you. You and the musicologist are one being, traversing these endless moors together, away from the trappings of society. And you're soundtracked by these haunting sounds. Together, you will musicologically decode these sounds with withering insights.
You gotta press pause. I need a cold glass of water. That was electric, Charlie. Welcome to Switched on Pop. I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
I'm musicologist Nate Heathcliff Sloan.
Yes, to be clear, Heathcliff.
Yes.
Got it. Okay. Just
Cliff.
Bass clef, probably. Not treble clef.
I believe bass clef is correct.
And yes, it's Wuthering Heights, the Emerald Fennell adaptation of the Emily Bronte book from 1847. The film stars producer Margot Robbie as Catherine Earnshaw and Jacob Elordi as Heathcliff, the orphan and lifelong lover of Catherine. This film is a cultural moment scored with a soundtrack by Charlie XCX and her producer, collaborator Finn Key. So this is the movie that everybody's talking about, with a soundtrack that is as haunting and horny as the movie. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to the marriage of film and sound and hear how this tragic romance of the ages has got everyone all hot and bothered. Pop quiz, Heathcliff, have you read the original book?
I have not.
Can I give you a Cliff Notes?
A Cliff Notes?
A Cliff Notes, thank you, yes.
Or Heathcliff Notes, that's the other way to go, but yes, please.
The puns are getting mixed. The metaphors will get mixed.
Brandon, can we get some sweeping scoring here for this section, please?
Yeah, exactly. We've got two estates in Northern England, in Yorkshire, off in the moors. We've got, on the one hand, Thrustcross Grange, a vast estate owned by the wealthy Linton family. And then on the other hand, Wuthering Heights, a dark and decrepit working farm that is home to the Earnshaw family, who've been there for hundreds of years. The book is like a fever dream with these nested stories and unreliable narrators. It's this multi-generational romantic conflict with class battles. The story's most obsessed over plot is the relationship between the tempestuous young beauty, Kathy Earnshaw, and her doting and sometimes violent lifelong companion, Heathcliff, who is an orphan who's brought into her family. She denies their love at one point in the book, marries the wealthier Edgar Linton from Thrustcross Grange, and enters a world of the trappings of wealth. The fallout is this broken romance that causes intergenerational trauma and endless heartache and haunting. It is what they call a gothic novel about obsessive love. It was scandalous in its time, even panned, but its story has endured, serving as the inspiration for over 20 or so screen adaptations.
Wow.
So this adaptation is released in quotations. Quote, Wuthering Heights, unquote. Writer-director Emerald Fennell wanted to make the version that her teenage self pictured or even fantasized about. It focuses on the core romance of these young lovers over the ages in a very surrealist atmosphere. And speaking with the Victoria and Albert Museum, Fennell described how she wanted to approach this film.
What's important to me is like building a world, building an imaginative world. And the Gothic is pathetic fallacy, which doesn't just extend to the weather, but everything. Everything they touch, everything they wear, everything they see, everywhere they go is a sort of reflection of their emotional landscape.
Cool.
This is a very deliberate film that is an act of emotional world building where every detail enhances the underlying emotion. And who is better at world building than Charlie XCX?
Yes.
Emerald Fennell called Charlie to write a song. Instead, Charlie XCX decided to write an entire album, a standalone album that also soundtracks the film. And she recorded it while she was in the middle of the Brat tour. As a brief reminder, Brat gave people permission to be messy on the dance floor. I think that this soundtrack gives people permission to be messy in their souls. Ooh. There's probably no one brattier than our lead character, Kathy Earnshaw. Mm-hmm. No wonder that the trailer to the film even featured music from Brat. They played the song Everything is Romantic in the teaser trailer for the movie. And it's clear that Charlie has fully internalized Fennell's vision for this Wuthering Heights. We can hear really the grand thesis in the second verse of her song, Always Everywhere.
On the water, your face on top of mine. A fevered dream of mirrored features, hungry eyes. I feel like home, still you pull away. You disappear to somewhere dark so far away.
This is a song about wanting to be at home with your love and your dark, decrepit Wuthering Heights home, and yet constantly pulling away, not being able to fulfill the love of your life, and it's all occurring in a fever dream. Literally in the lyrics right there, it feels like a fever dream. What is a fever dream to you, Nate?
A fever dream, you know, when your temp gets up to 102, 103, you start having these crazy visions, you know, kind of the reality and fantasy melding into one.
Yes, exactly. Let's hear how Charlie builds this fever dream romance on the soundtrack for Wuthering Heights. We'll start at the very top. The beginning of the first song called House. Nate, that's all you get.
I mean, Charlie, you said haunting earlier. That's the best adjective I could use to describe this opening. There is a sound that is kind of hard to identify. Is it like a rusty weather vane, you know, rotating slowly in the wind? Or is it a violin being bowed sul ponticello? I couldn't say, but it's very unnerving.
Charlie XCX didn't feel that differently when she first heard these sounds. Here is how her producer-collaborator Finn Keen describes them in conversation with Spotify.
We talked a lot about, like, be interesting to use strings, but then we didn't want to make it this, like, you know, super lush orchestral sound that would just feel kind of wrong for the film. The idea was to have sort of strings that were quite rough sounding. So, like, when we were playing with the players, we'd have them play very close to the bridge and create this quite harsh sound. We'd have, like, quite a small ensemble, so you could hear, like, the details of all the string players, and it would just sound much more rough and sort of textured.
When you were recording strings in LA yourself, sometimes I would, like, walk in the studio and it sounded so bad.
It is not a pretty sound.
I have to pat my own back for a second. When Finn was talking about playing close to the bridge, that's the term you use, sul ponticello. Literally, like, underneath where the strings are supposed to be played, giving that eerie, like, rough sound full of harmonics. Anyway,
you hear the hair of the bow. It's very organic. It's very creepy. It feels like a horror soundtrack more than a romance soundtrack.
You can see why Charlie XCX was like, I don't like that.
But it's perfect because the original takes place, I guess, in the Georgian era. This is maybe in the Regency or Victorian era. The film is not historically accurate intentionally, but clearly we're trying to evoke some kind of past. And so, like, strings are definitely the way to go. Many of the film adaptations of this movie have used giant romantic string orchestrations, but there's something very different when you get really close, you're way up close to the mic, and you can just hear the hair of the bow. Feels both beautiful and old and something new and creepy. It only gets creepier from here in the song House.
Can I speak to you privately for a moment? I just want to explain.
That's the voice of John Cale of the avant-garde rock group The Velvet Underground. Mm. And he narrates the introduction to the album and the introduction to the film. He was saying, hey, take a moment with me. I need to explain what's going on. I thought my whole life was going to be perfect, but something seems wrong.
Am I living in another world? Another world I created? For what?
Yeah. His voice is as grainy and raw as those strings.
Incredible.
What a great narrator, right?
And he's famously a violinist as well, so that hearing that violin is so appropriate as a sort of prelude to his wizened, gravelly voice.
Well, the way that he tracked violins for the Velvet Underground was a fundamental influence to Charlie in the entire aesthetic approach to this album.
Cool.
Here's Charlie XCX again from that same Spotify interview talking about the first time that she watched the Todd Haynes documentary about the Velvet Underground.
And within that, John Cale speaks about how whenever he was recording strings for the Velvet Underground, it was kind of essential that they be both elegant and brutal. That phrase really stuck with me, and Finn and I were talking about that a lot, and I think that's something that we really wanted to kind of bring into the world of the music that we were creating.
Elegant and brutal at the same time. That is so Charlie XCX, someone who's known for brash, over-the-top pop vocals through so much auto-tune against a cold, cavernous reverb, but songs that feel really real and personal at the same time. Hmm. Let's hear what happens when John Cale and Charlie XCX collide later into the song House.
If there's beauty...
Ram!
I mean, that's so epic. it's so good.
The name for that giant sound is called a bram. It's a thing that composers do to introduce a big, sudden, terrifying moment.
Yeah.
And it is an onomatopoeia.
Yeah.
Bram.
Oh, my gosh. That's fascinating, Charlie. I've never heard that term, but I've heard it. I mean, like, arguably the Dune soundtrack is like 56 brams in a row.
There are definitely a lot of brams going on in the Hans Zimmer soundtrack for Dune, but the urtext of the bram is another Hans Zimmer soundtrack, the one for Inception.
Yeah.
It became such a big sound that countless films since have copied the bram. Transformers.
After all we have done.
Batman vs. Superman. Dawn of Justice. Immortals. Oblivion, Rogue One, Legion,
oh my God.
Tron Legacy, G.I. Joe, Stranger Things, Battleship, Avengers, Doctor Strange, Pacific Rim, World War Z. That's a mashup YouTube by the creator Metzi. So the bram is just quintessential soundtracking, which is a kind of funny way to enter this entire soundtrack, because in many ways it's really marketed more as an album. So this is, House is really just the beginning. It's setting the scene. The film opens up actually with the public watching a hanging, then like camera panning off to the really terrifying home, Wuthering Heights, which is surrounded by dark cliffs off in the windy, foggy moors. The home is covered in black, shiny rock. It's made to look like it's almost perspiring. It's very claustrophobic. And we have this very cinematic opening with House. It is probably more brutal than it is elegant. I think we're going to hear more of that combination of elegance and brutality to paint this fever dream as we move through some additional songs. And I want to go next to Wall of Sound.
Unbelievable tension, wall of sound, no real reason, and I can't escape it. Unbelievable tension, wall of sound.
What are you hearing in the introduction to Wall of Sound?
I mean, first of all, more strings seems to be a theme here.
Yep.
Like an organic strings too, like a real live orchestra. And, you know, also on that organic tip, I hear a lot less autotune in Charlie's voice than we heard on an album like Brat. It's a more naked version of her voice here.
Hmm. Yeah, definitely very raw. So we have the elegance of the strings, maybe a little of the voice being slightly inelegant, a little more brutal.
Totally.
The strings, though, they have that same earlier quality. It's, you know, played really close to the bridge. It's close mic'd, and they're doing this technique called glissando, where you're just sort of sliding along the strings.
Yeah, very unsettling.
And they're sort of like going in and out of opposite directions. Maybe this is too far reaching, but it sort of has the feeling of like two people wandering through the moors, trying to find each other, never quite finding each other. And that's kind of what's going on in the movie at this point. This Q comes in at a pivotal moment when these young lovers are starting to flirt. They're playing pranks on each other, and fast forwards into their adult selves, where there's this very romantic, violent scene where a shivering Kathy is sitting by a fireplace, but there is no wood. And so Heathcliff picks up a chair, smashes it to make her firewood. It's a very aggressive act of love. And a few scenes later, this is where things get really hot and heavy. She has this whole sexual awakening scene, and they are maybe going to make the whole relationship official, but she just keeps second guessing herself. Every time I try, tucking myself backwards away from my desires, something inside stops me. Every time I try, something inside stops me. It's like, it's that thing of like, you know, you're an adolescent in love and you're like, I'm going to try to ask somebody out, but I'm going to totally fumble it. And we're going to turn this romance into this completely unnecessarily long drawn out thing, in this case of the film, for the entirety of their lives.
Charlie's so good at projecting confidence and awkwardness simultaneously.
Yes, she's wearing this on her sleeve. Unbelievable tension going on here. Just desperate. Tell me that you need me. And the voice transforms from that very sort of raw vocal we heard at the beginning to this completely reverbed out. It is such a cold and frozen kind of reverb. She feels like alone and frigid, running out into the moors of England. And it's also making reference to a larger body of music. The song is called Wall of Sound.
Wall of Sound, the recording technique innovated by Phil Spector when he was producing songs for the Brill Building girl groups like the Crystals and the Ronettes. You fill the entire frequency spectrum with sound.
Yep.
You've got like this dense wall. When you're listening on speakers, it just sounds like a Mack truck driving into your eardrums. It was a way of your music kind of standing out on the radio dial. You could hear that sound instantly.
And it's also kind of the sound of all-consuming, overwhelming love. Another example with some great naturalism and geological scenes would be the Phil Spector production on Ike and Tina Turner's River Deep, Mountain High.
Geological scenes. I believe you mean topography, actually. But
topographical, yes, scenes.
But yes. Your point is well taken.
Ike and Tina Turner are singing about obsessive love. Charlie XCX is singing about obsessive love. Both have big, gorgeous orchestras, overwhelming reverb. We are of incredibly different eras, but I think that Wall of Sound is a perfect metaphor for this film, where you are surrounded by this dense fog, an overwhelming love, a fever dream-like romance. But this Wall of Sound takes a bit of a different turn on the biggest hit on the album, Chains of Love. Here we are again in the moors, windy synths, reverse sounds, and chains slamming.
I'd rather lay down in thorns.
Yeah.
I'd rather drown in a stream. I'd rather let myself unfold.
More strings, too.
Oh, yeah. So that thwack, which kind of has the feeling of like throwing chains down on the ground, that's the sound of a bow smacking the string super hard.
I think not the string part of the bow, but the wooden part of the bow, I think. It's called colenio. You'd kind of whack it down with the wooden part of the bow to create that percussive effect.
Does it also have that like, what is the Bartok pizzicato?
Bartok pizzicato is different. That's where you pull the string so hard that it slaps against the neck of the instrument when it comes back down. But colenio is something you hear in like Berlioz's symphony when he's trying to conjure up like goblins and gremlins.
I'd rather lay down in thorns. I'd rather drown in a stream.
We have what? That brutal and elegant sound happening once again. This very dark and haunting romance. Did you catch what she was singing here? It was like,
no.
I'd rather lay down in thorns. I'd rather drown in a stream. I'd rather light myself on fire. Hmm. It's like, if I can't be with you, I am willing to endure the worst torture. And why is this happening? Well, because our heroine, Kathy, is trapped in the wrong relationship, the relationship of convenience with Edgar Linton, who she does not love, this awkward, bad romance.
Yeah.
And this song plays in the film at a moment of there's some amazing montages in this film. They are sumptuous visually. And she's playing yard games, going to parties. It's very sort of Mad Hatter montage of drinking tea and living this lavish life, which is not of her upbringing, with the wrong guy. And so what's going on is that she is trapped by the chains of love. So she's a prisoner kind of in two different ways. She's a prisoner to this relationship she doesn't want to be in, but also there's the chains of her lover, Heathcliff, who's off in the distance, who's disappeared from her. He's run away, and all she wants is to be back with him. And I think we get that, again, the fever dream romance, the elegance, the brutality is all here. You have those enormous sort of 80s drums soundtracking this power ballad, but those creepy strings are still haunting in the background. I love the continuity of sounds that we're getting throughout this record.
Shine a light through the fog for me for a moment, Charlie.
Yes.
Do any of these songs appear in the film?
I'm telling you, this is what we're hearing during that montage. We are hearing this song at that key moment where it's like, it's a song that, you know, it's one of those songs where if you're not listening to the lyrics at all, you might think, oh, this is like a slow ballad. It's got some power. It's got some heft. It's exciting. It's very much in contrast to the over-the-top beauty and glamour of the montage of her living this fancy life married to the wrong man. But, of course, the lyrics belie her outward appearance.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was the case where, like, maybe some of the musical cues appeared, but you didn't hear the full chorus. So I'm really struck by the idea that this entire song, like, suddenly emerges into the world of this, you know, 19th century British pastoral. I love the idea of that mashup.
It works because the film is so stylized. Yeah. Like, nothing about this film is trying to be real. So I think that the soundtracking absolutely fulfills that creative vision. The song that I think best captures the obsessive quality of this romance is a track called Out of Myself. And I think that it's interpreting one of the most famous lines from the novel. There's a moment when Catherine says, "I am Heathcliff," that like basically that they are one. They have merged. She is no longer herself. It is an all-encompassing, almost psychotic kind of love. And Charlie XCX paints that picture with the song Out of Myself. You can hear it in the chorus.
Lyrics referencing a scene from the movie Push My Head Against the Stone.
That there is a lot of degrading sexual activity happening
In
this movie.
Yeah,
so we have Push My Cheek Into the Stone. There is some pivotal scene of finding each other in the moors. There's some other great lines here in the next verse.
I'm begging to you on my knees. Please rub the salt in my wounds.
I'm willing to endure all kinds of physical pain and torture for the way that you make me feel. In the chorus, we had also heard her sing, "Put the rope between my teeth." There is a scene in the film where there's some interesting sort of play acting, like horses in the barn, if you will.
So that's cool, because I feel like if you're watching or seeing the movie, these lyrics, you know, conjure up those viewing experiences. And if you haven't, then there's something really kind of intriguing and mysterious and a little bit dangerous about this song.
Oh, yeah.
We've even got like kind of mini Brahms in there too, right? They're not like full Brahms. They're not like, you know, Inception Brahms, but they're like Brahm light or something.
The strings are kind of exploding upwards. There's these quivering synth stabs. And I think also worth pointing out, the chords are not resolving. It's just sort of stuck in motion. And yes, the Brahms are there pushing us along. The Brahms that had outlined this creepy house where we're clearly going to die now have a very uplifting moment in this beautiful the romantic song, which ends in a way that you're not so sure that things are as transcendent as they seem.
Ooh, yeah.
To be taken out to transcend oneself could be ascending beyond this life. And you can hear there's some underlying dissonance happening in those strings at the end. They are intentionally kind of rubbing against each other, going in and out of tune. And that leads us to the last song I want to listen to together. It's the final song from the album. It also plays at the end of the film. This is Funny Mouth, co-written with Joe Keery, who has been on the show twice before.
No way.
And oh yeah. And I think it's a perfect way to wrap up the Fever Dream. Hyper pop strings.
Everyone sees. Everyone waits and waits. Everyone dreams. And everyone breaks and breaks.
They really understood the assignment here. I'm very impressed.
The lyrics are on point. Everyone sleeps. Everyone wakes up. Again, in the original book, there's all these moments of like the narrator falling asleep, waking up and seeing ghosts. The fever dream narrative is in the film as well, in which all sorts of people get sick with flu and are, you know, on their deathbeds. And this idea of like when we fall asleep and when we're dreaming, where the boundary of reality and fantasy live, that is where this song lives. It has that, the elegance of the strings, the brutality of the hyperpop production of Finn Keane, her vocal being the perfect in-between of both brutal and elegant. And I think that's exactly what's going on in this movie. We hear this song, I believe, in the ending, as well as at a key moment where there's a sneaky kiss taken during a funeral when a black veil is lifted for a very morbid kiss.
I don't think there's a lot of people that could be asked to provide an original score / soundtrack for a modern adaptation of a 19th century Gothic romance.
Yeah.
And
she's the perfect.
Have it be both atmospheric and haunting, but also melodic and catchy. Capture the aesthetic of this bygone time while also like hitting all the markers of 21st century pop. That's not easy to do. And I feel like they nailed it. I don't know. It's really, it's pretty, my hat's, I take my, you know, top hat off to them for that one.
Charlie XCX is not the only person to have been inspired by this text. When we come back, let's take a look at how her rendition stacks up against some of the other great adaptations of the past.
In the wake of the release of millions of documents related to the Jeffrey Epstein case, the rich and famous are finally feeling some pain. But even with corporate resignations here, and with former Prince Andrew being arrested in the UK, the question remains, how did Jeffrey Epstein remain a thriving member of the elite for decades when everyone seemed to know what he was up to?
I don't think you could be friends with Jeffrey Epstein, whose MO was obviously having sex with young girls, even as Trump said, on the younger side, and not know his MO.
Untangling the Epstein conspiracy. That's this week on Today Explained. Every weekday and now on Saturdays.
Every generation returns to Wuthering Heights because every generation has unfulfilled and unresolved romance. And that feeling is going to outrun any single musical trend or genre. So we need to keep coming back to this work. We're going to listen to some of the best versions of the past and think about how they stack up. Before we listen to some of the more pop-style offerings, I want to just get a taste of some of the early Hollywood soundtracking. One of the best adaptations of Wuthering Heights was the 1939 version, starring Laurence Olivier and Merle Oberon. The soundtrack, which was composed by Alfred Newman, was nominated for Best Original Score at the Oscars. Here is the lush, romantic score of Alfred Newman from 1939.
That is old Hollywood, grandiose, Gone with the Wind style, like painted sunset on the back of the soundstage, that kind of vibe.
Let's check out a really different approach to soundtracking the film. The 1992 adaptation with Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche, the score was made by the great late Japanese composer Ryuichi Sakamoto. The emotion builds.
Oh, that was cool. In contrast to the Newman score, Sakamoto's piano chords are kind of unsettled. They modulate. There's something a little darker under the surface.
It's almost two-faced. You know, it begins with these very sort of sweet, tonal, a little melancholic melodies, and they're very, you know, somewhat predictable. And then you get that weird atonal modulated turn all of a sudden. And you're like, oh boy, it's gonna, this love is not a good love. But you know what is a great love is my love for Kate Bush, who has probably the most famous rendition of the Wuthering Heights. She has a song, Wuthering Heights, from 1978. And we would be remiss if we didn't take a listen. Great exposition to begin.
Out sort on of the winding, windy moors. My God, what an amazing opening line.
The harmonies are as windy and windy as the lyrics are. What is going on there?
Yeah, this song is like a music theorist's wet dream. We start in the key of A major.
Luckily, we have musicologist Heathcliff with us.
But then the next chord we get once Kate Bush enters with her vocal out on the winding windy moors, it's like A to this F major chord, which is not part of the key of A, down to E. That's chill. But then C sharp major, another chord that does not belong to the key. So just in these like two measures, we're traversing all these like different kind of landscapes. Maybe that's what's happening. The windy, windy moors are being sort of represented in this winding, windswept harmony. And then we get to the chorus. Chuck, can you spin a little of that for us?
Yeah, for sure. Haunting of the ghost of Kathy. Let me in your window, Heathcliff.
And at this moment, we have another shocking modulation. We were in A major. We moved to D flat minor in the pre-chorus. And now we're going to D flat major. What is happening here? It's all over the place.
Transcending all the emotions, like in the same way that the contemporary film paints emotions with wallpaper, this is painting this circular and unhealthy relationship through harmony.
And yet it's also kind of like what Charlie was doing, so catchy and singable and like kind of gets stuck in your head, even though it's a little weird and unsettled.
It's really strange. Going into the chorus, I realized that this might be spontaneous co-creation, but I do wonder if some of the later interpretations of Wuthering Heights were maybe modeled a bit off of Kate Bush. I'm not sure, but check out this sort of this cadence, these chords that she plays as she's going into the chorus.
It's like a sus4 chord.
Sus4 gives us this feeling of being suspended. We need resolution. And isn't it what we heard in the Sakamoto?
Yeah.
Right there, right? What about in Charlie XCX's Funny Mouth? Here it comes, right here.
Yep. Yeah, there it is. What the ring,
oh, not
what the
quite.
Ring, what the...
I wonder if some folks were nodding to Kate Bush a little bit. I know that in the filming of the movie, Jacob Elordi had talked about interviews that they would play the Kate Bush version on set. So clearly the inspiration runs
in
deep.
In the water, in the air.
Yeah. Okay. I have one more version of Wuthering Heights that I want to play for you that I hope will take you by a bit of surprise. Okay.
Even Heathcliff could not be prepared for this revelation. What is happening right now?
Celine Dion's It's All Coming Back to Me Now, written by Jim Steinman. Inspired by Wuthering Heights.
Get out of here.
This song, originally Steinman's collaborator Meatloaf, you may not know this, but Bat Out of Hell by Meatloaf, sold 43 million copies worldwide, making it one of the best-selling albums of all time. Wow. Written by his musical collaborator, Jim Steinman. Meatloaf wanted Celine Dion's It's All Coming Back to Me Now. Jim Steinman actually sued Meatloaf to prevent him from recording it and instead gave it to Celine Dion. He knew it had to be in the voice of a woman. Wow. According to Steinman, he said there's a great archive of his interviews and texts on his website. He said that It's All Coming Back to Me Now is my attempt to write the most passionate romantic song I could ever write. I was writing it while under the influence of Wuthering Heights, which is one of my favorite books.
Unreal.
This song is an erotic motorcycle. It's like Heathcliff digging up Kathy's corpse and dancing with it in the cold moonlight, and you can't get more extreme, operatic, or passionate than that. I was trying to write a song about dead things coming to life. Mm. I mean, is there anything more elegant and brutal and fever dreamish and It's All Coming Back to Me Now? Take a listen to the beginning and it's like you're back on the moors. A little bit of a piano bram.
Yep.
Strings. Wind.
Winding windy moors, indeed. Oh, literal wind.
So cinematic.
Literal wind blowing. Wow.
Yes. And then the beautiful piano ballad.
My goodness, that's pretty spectacular.
This is one of the most over-the-top, absolutely ridiculous romantic songs I've ever heard. And I'm sorry, Charlie XCX, but I think that this might be the pinnacle. It definitely would not be appropriate for the film. It's come out Valentine's Day 2026. But what other version of a Wuthering Heights-inspired song includes... Yes, Nate. Sleigh bells.
What?
Banished.
A little grouse. I didn't know Celine could growl like that. Wow.
She like this. And when you hold
banish is
like
also
that,
a very like gothic concept.
I'm very curious, though, because you actually made a reference to another great Hollywood film. Do you remember which that was?
Great Hollywood film.
Classic Hollywood?
Gone with the Wind. Oh, wow. No way.
We are Gone with the Wind. We've got some castanets. We've got some guitar going, which is the motorcycle in the music video. If you have not seen the music video, it is, it's wow. It's wow.
We might need to do a Jim Steinman episode at some point.
Yeah. I mean, this is really one of the best power ballads of all time.
That's quite a reveal. You really, sometimes you have these little, you know, aces up your sleeve and I'm like, oh, what? This is going to be anticlimactic. But that truly shook me to my core, this Wuthering Heights, Celine Dion connection.
When people ask me, how do I feel about, you know, the adaptation of Wuthering Heights, I'm going to say I had a blast. I love the music. But nothing compares to the 1996 music video of It's All Coming Back to Me Now, inspired by the same text. I mean, why do you think we have to keep returning to Wuthering Heights, a book about life, you know, 200 years ago?
I think there are certain texts that speak to us in different ways at different moments in time. And it was cool to hear the 1930s soundtrack next to the 1990s soundtrack, because I feel like that's such a good example of that. You know, the same book, the same film can have a different meaning depending on how it relates to what's happening in the world at the time of that adaptation. And maybe there's something elemental about this story, about this landscape that we keep coming back to and keep uncovering new interpretations and new insights.
I'd like to think that we keep coming back to Wuthering Heights for the same reason that we keep writing love songs. It's because we are insatiable. We are feverishly obsessed by love. In the same way that Catherine and Heathcliff are obsessed with each other, we just can't get enough love songs. Is there a better love story full of the great romance and the great heartbreak of life? I don't know.
It's almost like the chains of love are the ones that shackle us to these songs, Charlie.
The chains of love are what shackle me to musicologists. Heathcliff, keeping me back podcasting every single week.
I'm glad you brought it back to your dramatic romance novel intro for me, because I actually am a character in a romance novel.
What?
Yeah, I, you know, occasionally am inclined to Google myself. And for a long time, before I made a name for myself in the world, if you Googled Nate Sloan, what would come up was a character in a romance novel called The Cowboy and the Cossack by Merlin Lovelace. And the main,
wow,
the Heathcliff in that novel is named Nate Sloan.
I can't believe that I'm going to be sharing this with the public, but the top search result for my name was a now retired adult film actor. And so don't Google it. Don't do it. You and I might have our own little Wuthering Heights narrative. Who knew?
I feel like we're just giving more fuel for the slash fiction out there, but we got... Got to be real about clearly something very erotic about our name, something carnal that we can't totally explain. Okay, credits.
I'm not sure that these people want to have these credits now, but Switched on Pop is produced by Rihanna Cruz, edited by Alyssa Soap, engineered by Brandon McFarlane, illustrations by Iris Gottlieb. Our theme music is by Jossie Adams and Zach Tenario of Arc Iris, a member of the Vox Media Podcast Network, a production of Vulture, which is part of New York Magazine. You can subscribe at nymag.com/pod.
We want to hear your thoughts on Wuthering Heights and Charlie XCX's soundtrack. Sound off on our social media at Switched on Pop or our Substack chat. You can subscribe to our Substack by going to the show notes or to our website, switchedonpop.com. And
hats. Nate, it's the reason why we make a podcast. I don't know if you know that's available.
A decade ago, we said, how can we someday have a hat that says pop on it?
I mean, the Earnshaws in the film, they earn their wealth in the world of textiles. And so this has actually been, you know, over 400 episodes, a deep con, deep con. Please send us to Thrustcross Grange and buy some merch on the website.
We should have a bodice ripper on the merch site.
Let's start writing one, you and me. All right, that's what we got for this week. We're going to be back again next Tuesday. And until then, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Borough Talks, the Borough Market podcast, is back. We've got a brilliant lineup for you this series. We've got Elliot Hashtrudy talking all things offal at his amazing restaurant Camille. Brindisi's Monica Linton sharing her thoughts on the evolution of British cuisine. And the founders of Genki talking all things matcha. All of this, plus chats about the future of British cheese and the unique flavours of one of Italy's lesser-known regions. That's Borough Talks, the Borough Market podcast. Follow on Spotify today.